Securities and advisory services through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Good morning, Southeastern Connecticut. Hope everybody's doing well today. It's a beautiful, beautiful morning out there doing your errands, running to the kids' soccer game. I hope you're out and about and having a good time. My name is Dennis O'Brien. I'm president of O'Brien Retirement Investment Group, but it's just me and my wife, so don't think it's like 30 people when you come through the door. A client came through the door the other day, and my office is at exit 90 in Mystic, 232 Greenmanville Road. And if you know where Steak Loft is and the gas station, and Taylor Realty took over the fabric store there and redid the building in 08-09, which was bad timing for them at the time. But I rent the first floor of the office. I've been there since February of 2014. And the first year when I started the business, it's kind of scary. I first started a business. It's not a walk-in business. It's all who you know and everything, because when you're dealing with people's money, it really comes down to who do they like, but more importantly, who do they trust? So the first year, I said a lot of prayers at my desk, worked really hard, tried to get out in the community, tried to help people. I made a promise to myself when I started the business that I would never, ever, ever turn away a reasonable request for a donation. Now I may get a lot of calls Monday morning, but I always felt it was very, very important to work in the community and try to help people when you can. And I also swore to myself that the market that was being ignored, young couples, young married couples, there was no money in it for the established financial houses out there. Many of them want minimum accounts of $250,000, $500,000 household assets. They want you 65-year-olds and don't care much about the 25-year-olds. And I thought that was wrong, because I think who needs more help? At that point in time, I think a lot of the young kids need the help more. So the other thing I saw through the years is the consumerism, the spending, the I want it now routine. Before I came to the radio show this morning, I sat with my brain trust, which are a bunch of retirees that sit around McDonald's in the morning in Mystic, and these guys were a riot. I mean, politically incorrect, jokes, anything and under. Everybody sees these groups around town, whatever town you're in, East Lyme, up in Norwich, wherever you are. But these guys, I asked them, I said, what are the things you want me to say on the radio to the younger people? And they said, basically, you don't have to have it now. You can wait. Stop buying new cars. Drive an older car. Stop with the show and get with the flow. Save your money, save your money, save your money. And one old timer told me a story about how his wife took care of the money. And he worked for many years at the sound lab and everything else. And he said one day, about 20 years into his marriage, had two or three boys and whatnot, he said she called him up and said, basically, do you want to pay the mortgage off? And he was like stunned at his desk. And he goes, what do you mean, sweetheart? And he goes, I've been saving. We want to pay the mortgage off. He said, yeah, absolutely. So they paid the mortgage off. So, what he was telling me was he trusted his wife totally. She ran the checkbook, and she knew where every penny went. And she watched it like a hawk. And those old-time stories, which I like to hear, are part of the things I want to relate and pass on to the younger generation, the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things. Before we get going, I want to talk about what happened in the stock market this week, because many of you out there own stocks, and you might have heard me before talk about Millennium stocks and what's going on. But I'm going to read you an excerpt on a summary of what happened this week, and it was absolutely stunning. I haven't seen this in probably 15 years. Now, I've been watching the market I've been in the business 37 years, and I've seen ups and downs, as many of you older folks have seen also. And this is what happened. Here's the summary. Tech sector notches best day since March of 2016. Apple says iPhone X pre-orders are high. Chevron, biggest drag on the Dow. The NASDAQ was up 2.2% on Friday alone. And the regular Dow Jones was only up 0.14. So all the action was in the NASDAQ sector. Wall Street climbed Friday as a surge in the tech sector and a rally on Amazon shares helped push the NASDAQ to its best day in a year. Google parent Alphabet, Google's called Alphabet now, which nobody understands why they did that, gained 4.25% as revenues got a boost from advertising sales. Microsoft jumped 6.41% in one day after the world's largest software company reported further gains from its cloud computing services. Also lifting the sector were Apple, which rose 3.5% after the company allayed concerns about muted demand for its 10th anniversary phone. Intel soared 7.375% on its quarter results, topping estimates, and the chipmaker raised its full-year estimates. Here's the king, though. Amazon jumped 13.22% on Friday. One day. Responsible for the biggest boost in S&P 500, quarterly sales surge, its gains listed, blah, 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 blah. Anyone who's drawing parallels to the tech bubble of 1999 has to at least consider that the rally in these large names is really fueled in large part by earnings, not just hope, said Jack Albin, chief executive investment officer of a large private bank in Chicago. These are the ones that everyone wants to own, has to own, because they're the ones reporting the best earnings. They definitely came through, which is very positive. There are certain similarities between the tech bubble and now, but the underpinning of this rally are still a lot more solid. Adding to the positive sentiment was third quarter GDP data that showed the U.S. economy unexpectedly maintained a brisk pace of growth at a 3% level, despite a hurricane-led drop in consumer spending and construction activities. Basically, what we have here is a very, very strong market. We got about 2 minutes to go into the break, but remember the themes we talked about? The millennium stocks, the millennium generation, the other reason behind this. This is real. This is going to continue. This is going to gain momentum. And you have to be in this sector if you have cash. So one of the questions I'm going to answer every week is, what do I do with my money? And one of the things you have to do with your money, depending on your age, of course, is you have to get exposure to this sector because it is just beginning. I know they're up a lot, and I know you're scared, and I know you think you missed it. But you have to be in this sector. And I will help you do it. I will show you the companies that are dominating. And also we'll talk about what the current yields are out there, why the stock market keeps going higher and has to relate to the competition it has for your money, which are the very, very low yields out there. My name is Dennis O'Brien. My phone number is 860-415-9614 during the week. My website is www.obrienretire.com. You can email me, request an appointment, request the 10 commandments of retirement, which I will send to you. See you in a few. Bye-bye. Dennis O'Brien, President O'Brien Retirement in Mystic, Connecticut. Back again, 860-464-9490 if you want to call in with a question. Now, we were talking about the surge in technology shares last week, led by Amazon, which was up 13% alone on Friday. What the heck is going on? Do you remember I was talking about all the empty storefronts in Greenwich a couple of weeks ago? I walked around Greenwich and I was amazed by 10 or 15 stores that are empty, and it's because the millennium women are not shopping door-to-door. They don't have time, so they're online. They're shopping Amazon, Wayfair, you pick it, but they're out there shopping online. And And another thing the millennials are doing is, have you ever heard of Venmo? Venmo is a an app you put on your phone, you link it to your account, and you can send your friends money. Boom, $50 right there. The other day, a lady told me she went out to eat with seven or eight of her nephews and nieces, and the bill came to whatever, and they, none of them have cash on them. So they had put Venmo on her phone with her bank account, and they all sent her the $12, the $15. She said, I had the money in my account before the waitress came back with my credit card because each of the nieces and nephews had sent her the money at the table in the restaurant. And not only that, Venmo, here's the weird part that you old, anybody north of, say, 50 will think this is nuts, okay? And anybody south of 50 will go, what's the big deal? The age, you pick the age. The other, Venmo also links to your Facebook page, okay? So all your friends, and then when you send somebody money, you say, oh, Johnny, here's the money for the concert tickets. That appears on your Facebook page, and all your friends know you paid Johnny $50 for something. Is that nuts? I wouldn't want to know people to know, hey, I owed you money or I paid you. That's nobody's business except your own, right? These millennials, they think differently than you and I do. Totally different. That's like no big deal to them. So with that mentality out there, is it really surprising that these tech stocks and everybody who supplies them and everybody, how these millennials are going to act is very, very different than the boomers and the older crew, and never mind the World War II crowd and Korean War and Vietnam crowd. So that's something that's amazing to me. Now, the other thing is, before I get into my office at about 7:30, 8 o'clock Saturday morning to prepare for the show, and one of the things I did this morning was look at yields out there. What's the stock market competing with? If you can go to your bank and get 10%, are you going to be interested in stocks? Why take the risk? Not unless you think you're going to triple your money or something. So what are the yields of the stock in the local stock market? I had a little lady come in my office with her daughter. She has $100,000 at a local bank, and she earned $150 on it between her IRAs and her CD accounts. She says, can you do better? Well, I said, I do investments, so that's not the same thing, because savings accounts are guaranteed, investments are not. But that being said, I probably could throw you off about 6% in ETF current yields, and they'll go up and down in value, but you'll probably do better over time, would be my guess. You know, we can't make predictions, you know, in the business. Only Bernie Madoff makes predictions, and you know what happened with him. And if you want to talk about Bernie Madoff, boy, that is a story. I still shake my head and go, how are people so stupid to fall for that? You can't get 12% guaranteed. You can't. He was making up his own statements and sending them out, telling people we're getting 12% guaranteed. And he had a special secret sauce that enabled him to do it. Well, I remember Bernie Madoff. When I first started in the business in 1980, they used to have something called pink sheets. And some of you old-timers are probably smiling at the term. A pink sheet was literally about an inch thick. They were pink. And they were about 16 inches long, about maybe 8 inches wide. And it was just this long, thick, pink sheets. And these were penny stocks. And when you went through the pink sheets, you were looking for companies. Most of them were just crap. You know, they were penny stocks for a reason. They had one or two employees, Jim and John. They were working out a garage. Somebody had talked them into going public, but there was nothing there, and you didn't buy them. You know, for the most part, they were all crap, you know. But occasionally, I'd go through and just see. I like the names of the companies, and some of them were quite imaginative. But guess who the market maker on the pink sheet stocks was? Bernie Madoff and company. Sheet after sheet, Madoff would be making markets in pink sheet stocks. Now, market makers in pink sheet stocks are known as the worst of the worst. They'll go 2 cent bid, 8 cent offer. What do you want to do? You know, and so the spread was worth more than the stock, than what they were willing to pay you. They were considered, just thieves, you know. So when I'm reading Barron's in the late 90s, go 15, 20 years later, and he's this hot money manager. and he's managing money. I said, you know, does a tiger really change its spots? You know, Bernie Madoff of all people's running money. To say the least, I was extremely, you know, skeptical, shall we say. And so when there was a guy in Boston who went through his financials and said what he was claiming was impossible, and he went to the SEC a couple of times, and after a while, nobody caught on. Nobody caught on. Bernie was clever. He got on the right boards and everything else. But I always stretched my head and I said, I don't believe a word this guy says. And later, you know, and you know what blew Bernie up? He was getting away with it. But you know what burned him up? It was when the market crashed in 2008-09 and a guy had $5 million of Bernie Madoff, he thought. $5 million at Morgan Stanley and $5 million at Merrill Lynch. And his accounts at Merrill and Morgan went all the way down, and he was getting margin calls or whatever he was speculating in. Okay? And he said, oh, geez, Bernie hasn't gone down at all. Let me call Bernie and get some money. Right? So they all called Bernie to get some money. And Bernie had heavy withdrawals. And by December of 2008, all of a sudden Bernie was like, I need to get more money in because the money wasn't there. It was all a lie. It was all a lie. And so the 2008-09 crash actually did Bernie in for reasons that he didn't see coming. And so so there is, you know, it is what it is, but whatnot. Okay, so what do you do now with your money? Let's talk about that. One of the things right now, the 10-year U.S. Treasury is yielding 2.4%. So you write a government check to the government, they give you a bond on your statement, and you get 2.4%. Now, after inflation, after taxes, because you're going to pay taxes on it, what do you have left? Nada. Nothing. Zip. Okay? So there's very little competition for stocks from the bond market at this point. Okay? And that's why people sell, even when they sell in panic. Say the market corrects 10%. People panic. They sell their stocks, which they shouldn't do, and they wouldn't do with a good financial advisor. They put the money in the money market fund, like that little old lady, that local bank. They earn 0.15%, and then they see the market starting to take off again. So they go, uh-oh, I can't miss it, and they buy back again. So you get these crazy ebbs and flows in the stock market day to day. But anybody who trades the stock market is going to lose money. Very, very few make money trading the stock market. Do you know if you go into Warren Buffett's office in Omaha, Nebraska, and I had a guy I knew that was doing a documentary on him. He says, when you scan the office, guess what's not in there? A Quotron, a Bloomberg, a stock market. He doesn't watch the market tick by tick. That's not how you do it. He buys businesses and holds them. He's held Coca-Cola for, 30 years? That's how you do it. You buy good companies. In this case now, I think he started buying Apple. He bought IBM. I don't know if he bought Apple or not. I think that some of the younger guys got him into Apple and whatnot. IBM, I looked at it when he started buying it, and the new chairperson, Gina Rometty, I think, believe her name is, I'm not a believer yet, Gina. I'm not quite sure you have what it takes to turn that ship around. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but I don't see it. Talk about managements a little bit more. Let's talk about General Electric and what's happened there. Do you remember General Electric in the early 80s when Jack Welch came in? They called him Neutron Jack. Jack fired so many people that they called him Neutron Jack because there were empty factories. And he was like, you know, people were like, what's he doing? What's he doing? Well, Neutron Jack figured out what he needed to do to get GE, which was a mess at the time, back going again. And that stock went up 10, 15, 20 times in his reign over 20, 25 years. And he got that thing. That thing was running beautifully. And the shareholders were thrilled. And he made people a lot of money, and they wound up hiring a lot of people and businesses because he grew it the right way. Okay? And then his successor came in, and his successor wasn't nearly as competent as Jack. Now, I remember seeing Jack and his successor, I believe his name is Mr. Immelt, do a joint interview on CNBC when the transition was first made. And Jack was speaking, and Immelt rudely interrupted him. Said, no, 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 Jack, this is the way it's going to be from now on. Showing Jack no respect. And I went to myself, I said, I think this guy may be an ego guy. And the ego guy is, I'm going to do everything the opposite of you because I don't want to be under your shadow, and I don't care what it does. Well, turned out that Mr. Immelt did the opposite of Jack, and the stock, when he took over, was in the 40s, and now it's at 20 and falling, and the company's in horrible, horrible shape. So when you see an ego guy or gal get in there, and it's all show, and it's not getting stuff done, watch out, because management is everything. If you have good management, if you have good management of your companies, you're going to do well. If you have poor management, and if you don't believe me, just look around at local businesses that fail all the time. Good management succeeds, bad management fails. And so that's what happened. So General Electric going down, if you own the shares, I don't know, guys. I don't know. I don't know if Mr. Flannery has the stuff, the right stuff. He's the new guy after Immelt almost destroyed the company. We'll see what happens. Mr. Flannery may have the stuff. We'll see. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye now. Dennis O'Brien, President O'Brien Retirement. The name of the show is Retirement, Life, and Investing. And any of you out there go to eat at McDonald's or own McDonald's stock or ever worked at McDonald's? Probably half the population worked there. I know my sister did. Back in the 70s, it was a lot of fun, I guess. The kids would all get together and whatnot. But I was in McDonald's the other day, and I remember a story that happened to me because I got a lot of them that happened to me over the years. So anyway, I don't know if you recall, but back in 99, 2000, we had this tech bubble, all right? And every moron in the country went online and bought tech stocks, and they surged, and the internet was just coming in, and nobody really knew what they were doing. Nobody really understood the internet except a few people. So as this thing going up and up and up, it got so bad that they took really good companies like McDonald's and whatnot and creamed them from the 40s down into the low 20s, all right? So I call up all my clients. I said, you know, the real estate alone, McDonald's real estate alone is worth more than I think the stock's trading at the time. So I called them all up in 2002, whenever it was. I said, buy McDonald's. But this tech company, my brother would say, hey, buy McDonald's. So a lot of them bought McDonald's, okay? So this guy buys 1,000 shares at 21, and we'll call him Sid, okay? So Sid buys McDonald's at 21. Of course, now he's watching the stock on the ticker. Now, what did I tell you about Warren Buffett? He doesn't even have a computer in his office. The last thing you want to do is watch a stock after you buy. Because if it goes up, you get this euphoria that's meaningless. And if it goes down, you have a hatred for your financial advisor, which is also meaningless, okay? Unfortunately for me, the stock immediately went to 16. So he had 1,000 shares at 21. It goes down to 16. He calls me up. He called me every name in the book. And I liked the guy. And I knew he was just, you know, and he was a newbie. He had, you know, hadn't bought stocks before. So stock goes down to 16. And he is calling me every name in the book. And he is mad. Mad as my friend in Texas would say, he was madder than a dog in a pit. All right. He was mad at me. All right. I said, Sid, not for nothing. Let's hold it a couple of years. He goes, thanks for letting me vent. I'll talk to you later. Bye. All right. So a few years go by. Of course, we talk on other things, but we never brought it up, either one of us, because he was probably embarrassed and I didn't want, you know, I liked the guy. He was a good guy, good client, good friend. So a few weeks ago, he calls up. He says, listen, he goes, I've been reassessing my life. I don't know. Actually, I'm thinking to myself, oh, this is going to be good. He goes, and I want to apologize for you for yelling at you about McDonald's. And I, you know, because this was 15 years ago. And I said, oh, yeah. He was the one, right? I said, well, you know, I said, don't worry about it. I said, I barely remember it and everything else. He goes, have you seen McDonald's stock? I go, yeah, it's at 165. And he goes, thank you. And we're both laughing because, you know, at the time he wanted to sell it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, it's a hold it. It's a good company. He didn't trade it. He wasn't sitting there at E-Trade, master of the universe, doing that crap. Okay. And that is crap, by the way. And the reason I know it's crap is because I remember being at Advest and they put me on some board because the discount brokerage business was booming, right? So I said, I want 75, we're thinking of buying this discount broker at the time. And I said, I want to be able to pick out 75 accounts and 74 of them were losing money. And I turned to manager, I go, you're out of your mind. These people don't know what they're doing. First, the average account was $5,000. Okay. And they're blowing themselves up, and then, you know, you own it, they're going to be blaming you. So that whole thing went on and whatnot. But the moral of the story is not to tell you I'm brilliant or anything, but when something's low, okay, everybody, nobody's going to tell you, nobody's going to ring a bell, okay? And that goes into the story about why you should have a financial advisor, okay? I know a lot of you guys out there are doing it yourself. You go to Vanguard, you go to Fidelity, you're doing it yourself, or maybe you have an E-Trade account, Scottrade account, wherever you are, and you get the lower commissions and whatnot. And granted, many of you can do it, okay? The problem is, as I see it, is when we get volatility. When the market crashed in 08, 09, if you had a financial advisor and you wanted to sell everything, a good financial advisor would probably say, if you want to sell everything, that's fine, but not today. You know, let's wait till the market's up and kind of like, let's wait a month. Let's wait 2 months. And a good financial advisor will do that. Okay. They can't call the downturns, but a good financial advisor knows when things are too low. The market went from 14,000 to 6,500 in what? 6 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I don't even remember. Okay. So if you're going to sell to the other idiots who are panicking, a good financial advisor will stop you from doing that. Another thing, a good financial advisor will stop you from doing dumb things on the buy side. Your friends, your relative have a business idea. They come to you. And I've had a bunch of these through the years. And I say, all right, give me the business plan. Let's take a look. What do you got? Oh, I don't have a business plan. Well, who are the I don't have any other backers. Well, what are we basing this on? Well, don't worry. I promise I'll pay you back. I am your screener. I will make sure you can blame me and tell him, no, he didn't approve it. Now, this is especially true if you just come into money, sudden inheritance, a lottery winner, a athlete who suddenly hits it big. These are people to be fleeced by the professionals out there who are professional at fleecing people. And they will spin you a story, spin. And so you have to have someone there blocking for you and protecting you. And so Shaq always tells the story of when he first hit it big and started making, you know, tens of millions of dollars, he had this little old broker who put him into annuities, okay? And I don't like annuities, generally speaking. I think they're too expensive. I think they're overpriced. I think they tie your money up for 10 years. But in this case, Shaq would say, well, call Sid. Sid again, right? Call Sid. He's got my money. And Sid goes, oh, no, it's all in annuities. He can't get it for 10 years. And so by putting it in annuities, he blocked everybody from, you know, stealing his money or investing in crazy wild schemes. Now, we've all seen the horror stories of professional athletes losing all their money and whatnot. So talk about another crazy story is, I'll tell you this one. I was at Advest in Mariner Square, and it was probably in the 90s sometime. I can't remember why. It was Christmas Eve. And I think I was a young guy in the office, and everybody had left. I think there was one sales assistant still there. She stayed with me for some reason. And so it's around 4 in the afternoon, Christmas Eve, or 3, whatever it was. This guy comes in the office mad, mad drunk, screaming, right? I want to open an account. I want to buy this stock. And he's ranting and raving. And I said, come on in my office a minute. We sat down. Oh, the smell. The guy must have been drinking for 12 hours straight. He was drunker than a skunk, all right? And he's telling me about this, brother-in-law telling me about this great company. He's got $15,000. He wants to open the account tonight and buy the stock. I let him go on. You know, I was frankly enjoying it, actually, a little bit. And he went on and on and on. Finally, you know, I lowered the boom on him. I said, listen, sir, more than happy, come back next week when you're sober. And I'm more than happy to sit down and talk with you and review your situation. Okay? So he gets mad. He gets mad. He's one of those mean ones when he drinks. So he's ranting and raving at me. He's cursing me out. You see a trend here, by the way? So he goes, oh, I'll go down the hall. So I said, all right, go ahead. So there's another broker-dealer down the hall, much bigger firm, right? And I'm about to lock up. I'm getting everything together, starting to shut the lights. Knocks on the door, comes in. He goes, see, I told you. And I go, what? They opened the account for me. They let me buy the stock. And he waved a bunch of paper in my face and everything else. And I looked at the sales assistant. I just shook my head. I said, good for you, sir. I'm glad you got what you wanted. And so he went down the hall. You're an idiot. And he's just yelling all the way down the hall. And to this day, I always wondered, was he full of it? Did he really open the account? Or did he just, they said no too, but he just wanted to throw it back at me? I have no idea. I hope they didn't, but maybe they did. I don't know, you know. But for this day, I always wondered what happened to that drunk man on Christmas Eve. Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. This stuff happens, and you look back and you just kind of chuckle and go, really? Somebody really opened an account for that guy? But in any case, my name is Dennis O'Brien, President O'Brien Retirement, and you can call me during the week at 860-415-9614 or go to my website, O'BrienRetired.com. Talk to you in a few. Bye-bye. Southeastern Connecticut, Dennis O'Brien, President of O'Brien Retirement, 860-415-9614 during the week, and O'BrienRetired.com. You can call, email me from that site, and I'll send you my Retirement Ten Commandments, or you can hit the button and make an appointment, and we can sit down and chat. The next segment, our final segment, is why do immigrants save so much more money than you? And it's an interesting question. During the week, I had a immigrant come in the office. She was born in County Cork, Ireland, which was dear to my heart because that's where my mother's people are from. And when she walked through the office and started talking, I had flashbacks of childhood. You know, all my relatives getting together in Queens or wherever they were at the time. And the tin whistles would come out and the laughter and whatnot. And talking to her, it was wonderful to talk to her. She came to this country in her 20s. She just got laid off, 48 years old, never married, single. And she had acquired close to $1 million in net worth. Worked hard, worked very hard at her job. Was making low six figures, save. And she was a saver. And listening to her talk, I said, what made you work so hard? What made you save so much? And she says, I was scared. She said, I saw poverty. You know, Ireland wasn't as poor as some of the other countries that immigrants come from, but I saw tough times. She goes, I can't tell you about how the school was, you know, back when I was growing up. She goes, I can't look at nuns the same way. So I laughed, you know, we were talking about it. So why do immigrants save so much more than you? And I found a site, by a man named, Ramit Sethi, and he's from India originally, came to this country. And he talked about it, and what his comments were good, but the comments from the readers from around the world that have come to America and how they did it was even more fascinating. So let's talk about that a little bit. I am personally fascinated with the differences about how people around the world spend and save money. Having grown up around immigrants, I can tell you that their spending patterns are wildly different than the people who were born and raised in America. I was reminded of this a few days ago when I got this email from an immigrant, let's call him Raj, who's been in the U.S. for 10 years. Raj says, I live in Fremont, California now, and I have $150,000 with me in the bank. Most of it stored away more than 1 year now because I feel I need it to buy a house. Now, I've stopped thinking hard about the house since I don't know where I'll settle down, especially after reading your book to avoid buying a house as an investment. I've started reverting most of my money to life cycle funds and also opened an IRA. In my case, as an immigrant, I still send a lot of money to India where I have good contacts and usually earn as more than 8% on my money. There's a strong reason I never bothered to learn about investing here. But now I'm diversifying investing in both the U.S. and India, which is very, very wise because the GDP of India is tiny compared to the U.S. And I know it's growing, but they have a lot of structural reforms to do. All right. This is extremely common, according to Ramit, especially in the Bay Area. You get a single high-skilled guy who moves from India to a well-paying job in the U.S. He works his ass off, lives in a small apartment, and sends some of his money back to his family in India. A few years ago, he saved well into the six figures, which is the point he either goes back to India to find a bride and returns to continue to working, or less commonly, moves back to India with a nice bit of cash. This got me thinking, why do immigrants save so much? A few easy reasons come to mind. They're more educated, in the case of many of the Indians that come here. They earn more because they're more educated, tech, brain power. Their culture encourages higher savings rates, okay? Culture is also why some immigrants are stereotyped as being poor tippers, which is often very true. You know, there's no tipping back in their home country, or very, very little. I'm especially interested, Ramit says, about the cultural factors that affect their financial habits. From data from an EBRI retirement confidence survey indicate Hispanic Americans immigrant to the U.S. exhibit different saving rates among other Americans. They tend to save more for short-term goals as education or home purchase rather than retirement. And they're extremely risk-averse, playing more importance on safety rather than return relative to others. Also, they're twice as likely as natives to have provided financial assistance to family members, both in and out of the U.S., more likely to expect their retirement years to be financed by income of other family members. And for many households, these intergenerational transfers are a major component of retirement and savings. Very different than America, okay? If you can't understand, please go find an immigrant and ask him to translate for you. I think he's being a little sarcastic here, but I understood. I'm sure there's many other reasons that are more complex. New York Times had an article about obesity being contagious, and I've all along argued that personal finance behaviors are also contagious. You hang out with spenders? Hang out with savers? Maybe that has an influence. Personally, I remember, and this is Ramit talking about his childhood in L.A., with the six of us, lunch at even a fast food place would be expensive, so my mom always packed lunch and we'd stop somewhere to eat it. We never had a summer home. The whole concept was foreign to us. We never had the most fashionable clothes. My parents would spend a lot of money on activities and siblings and me, and didn't bat an eye on an SAT prep course that cost thousands of dollars. See their priorities was? Education, getting ahead, sacrificing for their children. Like I said, Ramit says, immigrants have incredibly different spending patterns than most of us. And then he puts it out to the public and his readers. What's your best example of difference between financial behavior of immigrants and he calls as Native Americans, which means Americans born in this country? One fellow, Matt, said, when I was in sixth grade, I found out that my friend from Pakistan had been paying the family bills and balancing the family checkbook for more than a year. His father said it was important that he learn to handle personal finances, and how much better than to learn by doing. I thought it was a bit crazy being in sixth grade, but my friend handles money much better now than most people I know. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, concept was, you know, teach the kids, let them run the checkbook, show them what's coming in. We have a taboo thing here where, like, don't talk about money. That's BS, guys. Talk about money. Tell bed stories about money. Let the kids know. Don't think all evil is rooted in money, you know, that Christian ethic. That's BS. Money is just a unit, a currency we use to transfer between us to create commerce. Money doesn't care. Money doesn't have emotion. It's not evil. Let's see. Some of the comments out there were very, very interesting, and oh, here's one from Alina. I think your generalization is reasonable. I love my American in-laws, but it drives her crazy how much money they spend on gifts at Christmas. They'll be there for Black Friday and spend thousands on five grown kids or spouses, 13 grandkids. On top of that, we have to give a gift for siblings. Drives me nuts. Kids were getting five or six gifts each. Too much. My family, immigrants, really spent money on gifts and going out growing up. Christmas is an opportunity to visit, hang out together, and eating, not to go crazy with spending. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. One person, Ian, said, well, one factor you miss out on is a lot of immigrants are used to a much lower standard of living in their home countries. While their income jumps quite a bit after they get to America, their standard of living adjusts much, much slower. Then Pranav got mad at that comment, and he said, basically, what makes you say that? Back in India, I was used to living in a four-bedroom colonial bungalow for three people, four cars, and staff to take care of every possible chore. Hate to say, but my standard of living's gone down since I moved to the U.S., sharing a room in L.A., no car, etc. And yet I save money and don't buy unnecessarily because everyone else is. In addition, the concept of taking a loan for everything is an alien concept for us. Most of us believing what we can afford and paying cash. And we don't like giving up our cash easily. I threw that last sentence in. But I know. I think the most insidious reason for the savings divide in American culture has steadily encouraged consumption versus saving more each year. If you know what to look for, you can see this in the quality of persuasive arguments embedded in the advertisements of today versus 20 years ago. I'm sure it's much more observable the further one goes back. Maybe I'm wrong, but when the President of the United States has tapped become a spokesperson to save the travel and leisure industry, think post 9/11, I think the cultural divide between a savings-based culture and a consumer-driven culture grew by leaps and bounds. I would say the biggest difference between cultures, particularly Indian Americans, I've noticed, is the ability to resist the immediate upgrade. And I got an iPhone 6, and I know. Just hold on to it. Instead of rushing out to buy something new, they wait to buy it secondhand or enough research to know when it leapfrogs technologies. One woman said her grandmother saves baby wipes. The comments are just fascinating to listen to, because it's very, very important to understand that these people, one comment was, and I can't find it right now, but they said, you know, if you go back to our home country, we know what real poverty is. And he goes, poverty here in the U.S., they still have cable, still have a cell phone. You know, most of the people are overweight that they claim are heavy poverty. So they said, we see real poverty. It scares us. So we're very, very careful. We know how bad it can get. So with those thoughts in mind, I just wanted to give you kind of different ideas of what people think when it comes to money and what goes on. Save your money, kids, because try to get on an automatic savings plan. Save first, spend second. You want to become an automatic millionaire at 60, start putting 10, 15, 20%. Automatically, as you get paid, put it away. You'll adjust, trust me. and watch those lattes, okay? Two packs a day, lunch out, a couple of lattes a day. That's $40 a day, and that's almost $15,000 a year you're blowing on the leakage. So be aware of that, okay? Need to reach me during the week, 860-415-9614, www.obrienretire.com. You can email me. I'll send you my retirement 10 commandments, and you also can hit the button and request an appointment, and there's never a charge for that. In any case, I hope you all have a great week, and stay safe out there. Bye-bye now.